Billy Collins is our guest here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell was just talking about the moment that took us to haiku, and you had a poem that you were willing to read to us that is your rendering of some of this idea.
Well, yeah, it's longer than a haiku, but it's a poem about looking at a drawing, a Japanese drawing, and it really, I suppose, turns out to be a love poem. It's called Drawing. Ink strokes on rice paper, a wooden bridge curved over a river, mountains in the distance, and in the foreground, a wind-blown tree. I rotate the book on the table, so the tree is leaning toward your village.
I found even things that had nothing to do with love, including many of your poems about death, to be love poems.
Uh-huh. I think there. Someone said all poetry is a mating call.
Well, that's a good one.
Yeah. And some people do it better than that.
You don't want to sound like an elk.
Well, unless your audience is...
Yeah, fellow elks.
Elk-like.
The elk
I would squads. Think that it... Go ahead, Bill.
The haiku, I think, comes out of the Zen tradition in Japan, or at least is related to that. And in some ways, it raises the notion of the ineffability of so much of what we experience, and what poems seem to do is to somehow or other get past language, mm-hmm. by using rhythm, by using patterning,
and
by using words to reach beyond literal meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
I think if you write clearly, you open doors to the mysterious by writing clearly. It's easy to write. It's very easy to write. It's not difficult to write difficult poetry, as somebody
said. And it's done a lot.
Yeah, it's not difficult to do that. The real risk, I think, is being clear. And I think the doors to the mysterious are doors that are accessed through being clear. And I think the poem for me kind of begins in clarity and ends in mystery. My favorite analogy for the poem is the eye chart, which has the big E at the top of it, which just about anybody can read. And then you keep reading down the eye chart, and at some point you hit the condition of illegibility. So it's P, L, Q, you give up. Well, a poem is like that, I think, in that a good poem for me starts with that obvious clarity, and we're all together with that as a kind of group. But at some point, the poem goes off into a kind of mysteriousness that can't exactly be deciphered. And it's that mix of the clear and the mysterious that I think makes a good poem. If you couldn't read the first line of the eye chart, it would not be fair. And if the entire eye chart were just composed of big E's, that wouldn't be fair either. It's this mixture of clarity and indecipherability, that I think poetry rests on that line.
I had the sense as I was reading this, and again, thinking about you in particular, I thought, well, I don't need really a job description, but maybe a definition. And it hadn't occurred to me until I was really immersed myself in some of your poetry, which was just delicious. You have to be brave to be a good poet. You have to be willing to say, here I am, in a way that most of us never either want to or are willing to. Is bravery part of this? Courage, maybe, is a better word?
I never thought so. I mean, it's common to say that this poet takes a lot of risks, but...
Oh, is it? Sorry.
I don't think it's courageous or brave. In my poetry, at least, I've invented a persona that is not completely me. So the speaking voice in these poems is more of a character than the autobiographical equivalent of me.
But that's not apparent.
This character resembles me in many ways, but he is an improved, new and improved version of me. If you're a novelist, you have to invent dozens of characters, sometimes hundreds of characters. If you're a poet, you have to invent just one character.
Yourself?
Yourself, yeah. The voice that will accommodate your life. So that's really all Emily Dickinson does, just to pull a name out of the air. She invented a character. You open Emily Dickinson anywhere, she sounds exactly the same. That's why we recognize her as a distinctive poet. Whitman, the same thing. You know, entirely different voice, but there is this Whitman character who, you know, long lines, great sense of bravado, and
when he was painting houses in the reality.
Yeah, embracing vision, and Dickinson stitching these little quiet, alarming poems together. But each of them has invented, as any strong poet has invented, a character, a way of speaking.
Strong, not good, strong.
Strong.
Why?
Well, I think strong for me means that a poet is a strong poet if all poets following that poet have to be aware of that poet. You can be a good poet and not have a kind of influence on future poets. But it would be hard to imagine poems written today that were written by people who didn't read, say, Dickinson and Whitman.
They would be diminished.
Something would be missing.
Newton talked about,
as in Isaac?
Isaac Newton talked about building on the shoulders of giants. And it's in the sciences and mathematics, that lineage is fairly clear. When you say that in poetry, it's less clear, at least less clear to those of us who are not poets.
Yeah, but you're a dropout.
Dropout is the generous thing. I'm a reject. But what is it that you're building?
Well, it's clear in the sciences because the steps, the progressive steps that lead to discoveries can be clearly traced back to previous scientific thinkers. It's less obvious in the arts and in poetry because the poet is trying to hide all his influences. You're trying to disguise your influences. What originality is in poetry is simply the ability to successfully conceal and disguise your influences. So that's why it seems to be original, but it's just a kind of stew, a concoction of various influences blended together in such a way that you can't separate them out again easily, like making a smoothie.
Indeed, indeed. Well, I don't want to leave it. I like smoothies. I make lots of smoothies.
That's a metaphor for you.
Yes, a good smoothie is a beauty to behold.
And taste.
This character notion, I want to go a little more with that. I had this sense when I met you yesterday. I mean, I first saw you, I thought, I don't know that this man sits naked writing his poetry. I don't know that he's willing to take off his skin and hang it up in the closet. I don't know that, I mean, there were all of these things I thought, I want to just meet this person and see what happens. And it helps me to know that it is you and it isn't you.
Well, it's my, you know, I suppose it's, you know, it's my imagination, right? And if I could tell you a real story about myself, about something that really happened, or I could tell you something that I imagined. Either one, both of those, I think, are revealing. The fact that I just made this up and imagined it it provides you with information about me.
It also opens up an enormous big door into places that you're not going to have the time or energy to go physically.
No, you just want to look and then go back.
don't want to live there.
It's just a peek. No, you don't want to stay there. You just want to take a peek.
A little further on that, if you don't mind, the notion that you can engage intentionally in places that you're not going to physically experience. I think an awful lot of us, just getting through the day, forget that we have options, that we can go places.
Uh-huh.
I once did a 30-something years ago, one of my first interviews in my life was with a woman who was a factory worker. And I said, what in the world do you do 8 hours a day sitting there assembling televisions in Bloomington, Indiana? And she said to me, this was probably the most shocking answer I ever got. She said, I travel.
Very good.
And she proceeded to describe this life of the mind where her hands were busy and she was making a living and feeding her children.
Yeah.
But she was living in quite a different world. And perhaps maybe 30 years later, she in her own way was a poet.
Yeah, I think that's a good, very good metaphor for poetry, I think. I think of poetry as travel writing. It's just not geographical. It's imaginative travel. And it does show that mindless activity has a great liberating effect on people. I think we sometimes condescendingly think that people with these repetitive jobs are in a condition of suffering all the time and immense boredom. But actually doing the same thing over and over again really does free the mind to some minds at least, to travel.
Let us travel forward and back in just a moment with Billy Collins here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell, and I invite you to be with us when we return.